This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Normal Police Pension Board member Mark Cotty acknowledges the fund has about half the assets it needs instead of the 90% mandated.
You're going to have either higher property taxes or better investments.
GLT's Ryan Denham reports in the policy debate for pension fixes, consolidate or deregulate. Hear how medical cannabis can be good for your pets. Laura Kennedy has more during an edition of Animal House. And Town of Normal Mayor Chris Koos is in the studio to talk about new spaces for outdoor dining in Uptown. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's May 22nd, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Normal Town Council has given the green light for an outdoor seating area at an Uptown Normal wine bar, a pilot project that may lead to more so-called parklets at other businesses. GLT's Ryan Denham covers that and more with Town of Normal Mayor Chris Koos.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays following the regular and special council meetings. Mayor Koos, thanks for coming in today.
Good to be here.
Well, let's start with the news from last night's meeting. The council signed off on that pilot project for the Stave Wine Bar to add an outdoor seating area in what was a parking spot right outside its front door. You supported this idea. Why?
I think what it does is it brings life to the street, and that's very important in terms of a vibrant uptown. You know, when we started having some of these outdoor events like Medici's 10th anniversary, Rock the Block, things like that, people really like being on the street in good weather. So I think it makes a lot of sense.
Gotcha. And the vote was 6-1 last night. Council member Jeff Fritzen was the lone no vote. He raised some safety concerns. It's a low speed area, but he wondered, what if someone swerves to avoid something, swerves into the seating area? And also, what if it catches on? And how many of these might there be ultimately? What safety concerns exist then? Did you have any safety concerns about this at the get-go that were somehow put at ease as you talked about it more?
Well, I did early on, but town staff and the owner of the wine bar both recognized that those were issues that needed to be addressed. And the way the parklet is structured, it's giving some protection to the people sitting there. With the traffic congestion, which isn't really bad, but traffic moves at about 15 to 20 miles an hour through the uptown area. And that's a good thing. And that's really by design of how we did it. So I don't see it to be a problem.
Gotcha. Well, how far do you think this could go? If this goes well, this particular pilot, are you open to seeing one of these on every block in uptown, or how far do you want it to go?
We talked about that, and, there has to be a balance between how much on-street parking you give up and how many of those you allow. So, we haven't made a decision one way or another about how that's going to happen, because this is really a test project, and we're going to see how well it works. If it works for the business owner, it makes economic sense for him to do that. And, any unforeseen problems that we might have. But we are going to be mindful of not taking too much on-street parking.
Yeah. And speaking of parking in Uptown Normal, even if there are giant parking garages nearby, which there are, there is still that perception of not having enough parking in Uptown. Do you see any way to kind of chip away at that perception? Or is that something you think you'll just face sort of indefinitely?
No, I don't think it'll be indefinitely. But I think as younger people get older and us older people disappear, hate to say it that way, I think you're going to see a change in that. There is kind of a mindset right now. A certain group of people said, I will not park in a parking deck regardless. I will choose not to go if I go into a deck. And I think that'll change over time.
Is there something you can do from the way you handle pricing or how much you pay to park in the different places that you could maybe flip the thinking, the mindset on that?
Yeah, I think there is, and I think it's something we need to look at. You know, it's interesting when we have large events like Sugar Creek and that, the decks fill up. People are willing to do that. But, you know, the idea of I'm going to go to Medici and have dinner, I'll drive around the block six times to find a parking place instead of going into the deck.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Mayor Coos, let's stick with Uptown for a few minutes. Your city manager, Pam Reese, was here a couple of weeks ago, said that the town council will likely see a design concept for the Trail East project next month. That's the mixed-use project that would be on the northeast arc of the circle by that mural. What are you going to be looking for? And what do you want to see in that concept? What are your priorities?
Well, you know, I think being sensitive to total uptown design standards that we have, we ask people to mirror the old a little bit and be compatible with what's old in the uptown area. But a lot of it is driven by who the tenants are going to be. And we're seeing that in design. You know, some of the design concepts that they've talked about prior. The function of the building in terms of the number of tenants it has and what kind of tenants they are really going to do a lot to design drive the design.
And it's going to be the two guaranteed tenant, Farnsworth and an unnamed IT firm?
Well, and yeah, and there's a third tenant that's very strong right now who has chosen not to be identified.
Can you say what kind of tenant? Is
office.
It retail?
It would be office.
Office, okay. Mm-hmm. So there's been a concern about whether this Trail East project would lead to demolition of those three older buildings on Beaufort Street, including that mural. Here's what City Manager Pam Reese said about that mural a couple of weeks ago on GLT.
And if the mural is gone in the future, I think it'd be incumbent on us to find some sort of replacement type of experience for citizens. If the mural is replaced with public art, maybe that's an option.
So what do you think of that idea, finding another home for public art to replace what may be lost with the mural?
I think, you know, that's part of the uptown fabric, to have those kinds of things. And you know, you have a mural now. Does the next thing have to be a mural? Does it all have to be murals? No. I mean, the mural concept was kind of ephemeral in its startup, and you know, it stands on its own for that. I'm looking at two other spots in the uptown area where we've done some significant sidewalk improvement, and we have blank concrete walls. Now, there's an opportunity for something there. Is it a mural? Is it a mosaic? Who knows what it is? But, yeah, there are plenty of other opportunities to do that, and public art or civic art is very important to the fabric of the uptown.
And it's been more than 5 months now since this project started taking shape and those three buildings on Beaufort came into play, at least from the public's view. So 5 months later, what is your sense of the council's preference for what happens to those three buildings? Do they stay? Do they go?
I think they're waiting to see what the developer thinks they need on that site. I think they're going to be open to it. You know, they're also have to be open to the condition of those buildings, and you know, I'm not going to go brick by brick on what it is, but there's some real trouble in the buildings, and some of the others are fine.
And Pam Reese has referenced, yeah, there was at least a few hundred thousand dollars of rehab that would be required at least on the one building that mm-hmm. the town owns already. Well, Mayor Coos, I want to pivot here while we have a few moments left, pivot to the Illinois General Assembly, just because we're coming up on the end of their legislative session. Lawmakers want to wrap up a budget by July 1st. I'll pause for a laughter line there. The Illinois Municipal League is raising concerns about one part of the governor's proposed budget, making permanent a 10% cut in how much income tax money that cities like yours receive. That was passed in 2017. It's a one-year cut, but there are concerns that could be made permanent. Is that something the town is worried about at this point?
Well, it absolutely is. I mean, we're seeing lower sales taxes in both communities here, and there's a myriad of reasons for that. You know, when that sales tax was bargained years ago, there was a carve-out for municipalities to have a part of it. And so I acknowledge that the state has got some significant budget issues that have to be dealt with, but in a sense, they're saying there's a portion of this we're just not going to deal with. Cities, you have to figure it out, and you're going to pay the burden on that. And, you know, there are other things that have been proposed down the road that there's no discussion on, which surprises me because there are things like taxes on certain services. You know, the states around us that everybody says Iowa and Indiana and Wisconsin are doing so well. Well, they have those. The other one is Jim Thompson proposed this a couple of years ago when he spoke in town, was a penny per transaction at Chicago Board of Trade. And people said, well, Chicago Board of Trade will leave Chicago. Well, they did it in New York, and New York Stock Exchange didn't do that. They did it in London, and the London Stock Exchange didn't do that. And it could raise some significant revenues, you know. And it's going to take a balance of that, and it's going to take, in my opinion, it's going to take more revenue than cutting more out of the state budget. Jim Edgar spoke to Illinois city managers and said, you know, when I was governor, there was fat in the government, and we cut it out, and it's been cut out since then. He said, but current state government is awfully lean, and there's just not a lot of room to cut.
And what's an example of a new type of tax on a new type of service that maybe has been tried in other neighboring states that you think, maybe give that a try here?
Well, let's go to my own business. We have a labor component. Our sales tax on the labor we do on our repairs in our thing, in our business. Why not? If that helps fix the budget.
Well, it seems like cities and towns have been kicked around pretty good in Springfield in the last couple of years. I mean, a lot of institutions have been nonprofits. I mean, a lot of them, but cities and towns especially. And the Illinois Municipal League is your advocate down there, representing cities like Normal, like Bloomington. Do you think they do a good job?
Well, I think currently they are doing a good job. There was a change in leadership in the Illinois Municipal League and a change of structure. And currently, I think Brad Cole, the executive director of the IML, is doing a bang-up job. But, you know, he's only been director for a couple of years, and it takes some time. But I do hear that the influence of the IML with the legislature is a lot stronger than it has been in years past. So I'm willing to give Brad some latitude and let him do his job.
Mayor Coos, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Good to be here.
I'm Ryan Denham.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. You're listening to Sound Ideas. The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us most Tuesdays following their regular and special council meetings. Next week, you'll hear from Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner.
Support for GLT comes from Cefcu, partnering with car dealers throughout central Illinois to make the auto loan process quick and convenient. Competitive rates for qualified buyers. Online pre-approval is available. Cefcu, not a bank, better. Details at cefcu.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Ahead during Sound Ideas, find out why you might want to get your pet high. There are benefits to medical cannabis for animals. The details are ahead during an edition of Animal House here on Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The organization representing Illinois cities is pushing for legislation to consolidate hundreds of police and fire pension funds. The Illinois Municipal League says the change would save money and be less bureaucratic, pointing to the success of the Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund. That's the pension fund for city employees who are not cops or firefighters. GLT's Ryan Denham asks the president of Bloomington and Normal Police Pension Funds what they think of the idea. Mark Cotty is a retired Normal cop. Paul Swanland is a detective in Bloomington. Cotty says he doesn't want to lose local control.
I don't think it's a good idea at all, and for a lot of different reasons. It sounds good, perhaps, in theory, but in a practical nature, it creates some real issues. There's going to be a huge cost for all the funds to divest themselves. One study that was actually done for the Municipal League say that back in 2012, it would be a $100 million cost just to liquidate funds and then for this consolidation. So that's one issue that I clearly have that causes a problem. And the other, you lose local control over funds. And I think that local municipalities, local boards have more of a feel about how they want to invest and how they want to put their monies and make those types of decisions. And it would disrupt the funds. It would take, I think one estimate I read was 11 years for this to even begin to break even. So on paper, it sounds good, but there's a practical nature to it, and it's very costly.
Paul, what do you think of this idea generally?
You know, back in 08 and 09 when we had that huge collapse and the stock market was doing terrible, everybody was losing money. And I think it took most funds on average about 7 or 8 years to recoup from that loss. So we're talking about something we're going to do to ourselves. You know, it's like a self-inflicted loss. It's going to take even longer nowadays, because that study that he's referencing was done in 2012. So that's in 2012's numbers and assets and everything, looking at it back then.
There are 653 police and fire pension funds outside of Chicago at this point. Each one has its own board, making decisions to protect and grow its assets, looking out for other members and retirees. So, Paul, you serve as president of the Bloomington Police Pension Board. So what does that board actually do? What is your charge?
So the board is made up, it's a five-member board. Two of the members are active officers who are elected by the active officers on the department. There's one retired officer who's elected by the retired officers from that department, and then two other people who are appointed by the mayor. The decisions that we're tasked with making are how the money's invested. That's a huge decision, and we get a lot of it. We have investment advisors that give us advice and give us direction of where we want to go for long-term sustainability and growth. And then answering questions that come up amongst active officers throughout their career, answering questions with retirees if they have issues or problems. The local boards are also responsible for disability hearings, sitting in on disability hearings if we have an officer that gets injured, either on or off duty, and is not able to work. We decide on that issue. And then just like day-to-day operations, paying bills. There's various bills that are associated with a fund, especially when you get to a fund that's larger in size, like Bloomington and Normal. You know, Bloomington has accountants that work to keep the book straight, and actuaries that work for us, making sure that we're following the statutes and the guidelines put out by the Illinois Department of Insurance.
For taxpayers, these police and fire pensions are a big deal. I mean, for their city portion of a person's property tax bill, it's about a third of it generally. Normal just raised taxes this year to cover police and fire pensions. So, Mark, can you talk about, you've been doing this a long time. You've been on your board for quite some time. Do you view this job as a pretty big responsibility, given what's at stake, not just for taxpayers, but for your members, your retirees?
Yes, I do. It is. It's a huge responsibility, and it's one that all the board members take very seriously. And we continually go to training, by the way. There is 16 hours mandated training, 32 hours initially when you come on, so you understand how to investment language, investment strategies, and everything else like that. So it is a huge responsibility. And as a board, you know, our task is very clear that we are fiduciaries of the money. So our main concern is the protection and growth of the fund, because the five-member board has exclusive control over that money, exclusive. And that's good, but it also creates a huge responsibility when we're, for all the millions of dollars that are in our fund. We're over a little over $30 million in our fund. Now, with that being said, and we try to balance that with knowing that whenever we make investment decisions, that we want to look at the very long term. We don't make risky investment decisions, and that's why we use an investment advisor. And that also we're very strategic. A couple members on our board, one is an attorney appointed by the mayor that works in finance, and the other is a retired a person from Country Financial that ran their defined benefit plan. So we have the knowledge and the basis to do it, and we take it very seriously, knowing that the taxpayers are paying for this.
Well, Paul, can you talk about your experience getting trained up on this stuff? Presuming you didn't go to school for finance, you're a police officer with Bloomington. How does one become knowledgeable enough about finance and how pensions work to do this kind of job?
Yeah, the training's pretty intense. It, like Mark said, it was 32 hours, and it was taught by finance professionals, people that work in finance, people that work for large corporations, attorneys. And teaching you a little bit about some of the terms that you're going to hear when talking to your investment advisor and talking to the actuaries and just trying to understand the lingo, because every profession has their lingo. And so understanding the lingo is the biggest hurdle to get over. So once you understand what everybody's talking about, you can kind of work with them to make those smart decisions. But it was a lot. You're getting exposed to a lot that you don't have the background in.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm speaking with Paul Swanland, president of the Police Pension Fund for the City of Bloomington, and Mark Cotty, the president of Normal's Police Pension Board. We're talking about a proposal from the Illinois Municipal League to merge the state's hundreds of police and fire pension funds. Mark, you've said you have two major areas of concern. The first is that merging these pension systems would be costly because you'd have to divest your assets and build something new. What about that second area of concern, the loss of local control? Why is that concerning to you?
Well, local government, it just goes back to the philosophy, I believe, that I have anyway, that with local control and local government, you are closer to the people that are making the decisions. And there is a sort of a responsibility. You have that closer tie with the community. If you turn the money over to a state fund, You lose that ability. You lose the ability to handle it the way that you think it should be handled. Because really, it's the taxpayers' money from the town of Normal. It's not the state of Illinois' money. It's the town of Normal's money. And honestly, I just to be somewhat blunt, the state has not managed their money well. They have not. And I would be very nervous to turn over the $14 billion that we're talking about to the state, who the five funds that they have been mismanaged, to be quite frank, and they're woefully underfunded. And I don't want to see us fall into that position, because most municipalities are doing well. There's some that aren't, but that can be dealt with on an individual basis. One of the reasons I think they really want the consolidation is to say that they can make better investment decisions. You know, a huge fund can get better returns. But that's not always so. Our returns are fine. Our returns are doing very well. And if they want to help us with the returns, Ryan, what they could do is change the legislation, because they do not allow us to invest the same as a business would, or even as a huge organization like IMRF. We have to have our assets in certain asset classes. And if they were to free that up, we could actually get better returns. I know we could.
Let's unpack that. How are your investment decisions overly restricted right now, in your view?
The state says we can have 65% in equities, and then the remaining 35% have to be in fixed income. Mm-hmm. And fixed income are treasury bills, CDs, things that are guaranteed by basically the federal government. The problem with that is that you don't get returns on your fixed income. We haven't in the last 10, 12 years. So we do really well on the equity side. I mean, our equities, we're making a lot of money on our equities, but it brings us down overall, because our fixed income, we're just not, when you're talking about only getting 1.5%, maybe 2% on your fixed income, that's just a drag on the fund.
Is that because interest rates have been just generally so low?
Exactly. So we could have rebalanced if they would. I mean, we're at 65%. I know Bloomington is at that limit too, or a little bit above it. But we're at that limit. So if we could go higher into equities, we could make more money. And then if the economy changes, then we can shift back to fixed income. But we're not allowed to shift like the private investor could, or even a large corporation, or IMRF. They shift back and forth by how things are going. We're locked in. And that, the 65-35 rule, is what's really hurting us right now.
Is the thinking that, like, allowing you to shift like that would be too risky, allowing you guys to get too much into equities? Is that sort of the thinking?
I don't know, but I assume that's probably what they're thinking, that we don't know what we're doing, and so they need to control us. But in actuality, no. You look up the makeup of our boards and our investment advisors. These are professionals that manage many funds. many funds. Some of the investment advisors we use have billions of dollars of assets they manage. They know what they're doing.
So I think supporters of this idea would probably come back and say, well, look, there's this example of the Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund, the IMRF, which is how municipalities handle retirements for non-uniformed staff members like the City of Bloomington's finance department or whatever. In looking at something like the IMRF, which already exists as sort of a precedent for this type of thing, what do you see in the IMRF that maybe that troubles you or is concerning to you enough that you think, well, if it worked like that, I don't think that's how it should work for these particular funds?
When you're talking about IMRF, you have to understand that IMRF, when it was created with the concept to cover all the municipalities. So that was its main purpose when it was created. We're not talking about transitioning from 600 and some pension funds into a consolidated fund. Now, the way that IMRF manages their money, I think, is great, and they do a great job. And the reason why they have better investments than probably anybody else is because the legislator lets them, which goes back to my point that they need to free up our ability to invest like that.
So another point that supporters of this concept may make is that you have all of these individual pension funds around the state, and they all have investment advisors, and they're paying fees to have experts come in and advise them on what decisions to make with their investments. And they would say that that's wasteful. You could consolidate that type of decision-making at a larger scale and save money on those types of fees. What do you think of that idea? Are pension funds like yours needlessly spending money on investment advisor fees?
Certainly, I would say that in theory, that if you put them all together and you had one investment advisor, you probably would save some money on fees. I wouldn't argue that point. But the fees that are going to our investment advisors are not that great. We bid it out. We are required to do so every 5 years. And so we pick our people based upon the expertise that they have and also how much it's going to cost us for them to manage our money. So it's a competitive business. When we put out our requests for proposals every 5 years, the companies that are bidding for this, they know that we're looking for competency and we're looking for value. And so we actually get we get some really good deals from our investment advisors because they know that they have to, because it's a competitive market. And when you have competition in a free market like that, you're going to get the best person, best firm, based upon that competition that we're using. So, no, it's really not that expensive to hire someone to manage our money, actually.
Your pension funds are now about 52% funded. That's the value of your fund's assets divided by total liabilities. Your municipalities and you're legally obligated to get by 90% funded by the end of 2040. So how do you get from 52% to 90% in that span of time?
The way that the money comes into a pension fund, so that people understand that, comes through property taxes. Generally, cities can, if they want, they could have a sales tax that goes directly. They're not prohibited from that. But currently, the common way is property taxes, investment returns, and then the amount of money that the employees put into the fund. So to grow that, you're going to have either higher property taxes or better investments. We choose to look at trying to get better investments. And the way that we can do that, again, and I just don't want to harp on this, but free us up so that we can get better returns. We're beating the market. I know normal, we beat the market last year, meaning that we beat the S&P. We've always have, basically. But we could do much better if you let us free us up. Every investment advisor I've ever had says, you've got to change the statute. It handcuffs us. We could get better returns for you because you're not following what the model would be, the industry standard. What we're doing is not the industry standard because the state says we can't use that standard.
Generally, how good or bad a job have the cities of Bloomington and the town of Normal done in terms of making their contributions into the police and fire pensions?
They've done a really good job. I mean, there's no complaints, at least from where I sit. Bloomington has passed a similar ordinance to what Normal has about making sure that they want to be 100% funded by that 2041 versus 90% that the state's requiring. I have to commit commend the city council and the mayor and all the people in the local government that work to set that goal. It's a very lofty goal, but it's an important one. And they realize that they can't kick that can down the road to future council members, to future leaders, that they have to take responsibility for it now. It might hurt. It might be a lot of money now, but down the road, in the long run, their contributions will go down. It will be less money that they'll be required to put into the fund, and it will get better down the road.
That's Paul Swanland, president of the Bloomington Police Pension Fund, and Mark Cotty, president of the Normal Police Pension Fund. I'm Ryan Denham.
Republican State Senator Pamela Althoff has proposed 5 bills in Springfield that would achieve various degrees of pension fund consolidation. The plan is also backed by the nonpartisan Civic Federation. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
This week in This American Life, Madonna worked security at an airport, a job she really loved, except for her supervisors, who did some pretty bad stuff. But Madonna, she does not accept the world as it is. She reads a lot of businessy, self-help, lean-in kinds of books, and so she decides to put them to work to fix her situation. How that goes for her this week. Listen Saturday at noon on GLT, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from State Farm Bank, offering mortgage consultation and rates to help you move from renting to owning your home. Additional information available by calling 1-877-SF4-BANK. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. NMLS ID 139716. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Gun violence in Illinois is not limited to Chicago. Several central Illinois cities have been trying a program that can be boiled down to a fairly simple idea. Tell people to stop shooting. Illinois Newsroom's Brian Mackey reports.
Conversations around gun violence often revolve around long-term solutions, like improving schools or the local economy. But even if those things were easy, and they're not, it would take a generation to realize the benefits. And for the Illinoisans living and dying in these communities, mostly low-income black communities, they don't have time to wait.
There's a lot of worry.
Jim Artis is the mayor of Peoria, which has had hundreds of shootings in the last few years.
The parents are worried about having their kids outside playing.
So a number of years ago, Artis and Peoria law enforcement teamed up with community leaders to try something different. They call it Don't Shoot. Champaign-Urbana followed with Fresh Start, and now Springfield is launching Focused Deterrence. Three names for the same simple set of ideas. You start from the fact that most street violence is caused by a relatively small number of people who run together in gangs or other small groups. They also happen to be the people most likely to be victims of shootings, too. You bring them together at what's called a call-in, and you deliver a three-part message. One, you're creating havoc in the community. Two, if you want to leave gang life, we will help you. And three, no matter what you choose, you must put down your guns.
If you don't, the bad things can happen, and we're here to tell you that we will enforce the laws.
This is Patrick Hansen, one of the lead federal prosecutors for Central Illinois. Having the U.S. Attorney's Office be part of the law enforcement message is meant to convey that the government isn't playing around.
I think it really does surprise people at how much time they could actually be looking at with three prior violent felonies. That could be a life sentence for somebody that's carrying a gun.
But the promise of swift and certain punishment is only part of the message delivered at a call-in. There's also a strong community component. At Springfield's call-in, recording was not allowed. But 8 men, all young, all black, heard from a minister, 2 former gang members, and 2 parents whose children were murdered. The men sat in a semicircle, some hunched forward, hanging their heads, others slouched back. A few seemed to laugh at inappropriate times, but something seemed to get their attention, like a grieving mother who got in one man's face and snapped, "Do you want your mama to see you in a casket?" He shook his head. No.
That night can be a very emotional time.
Tracy Parsons has helped coordinate all of Champagne's call-ins. He says it's hard to judge right away whether the message got through.
I know if you have a guy who's been living a life of criminality, to think we're going to change him in a year, 6 months, that's not very realistic.
Parsons and others involved with these programs say the offer of support, like help getting a job, is important because it shows the community is sincere about getting people on a different path. But ultimately, that stuff is a means to another end.
This is really about stopping the shooting incidents. We'll continue working on those other social and economic issues, but this main focus is to stop the shootings.
Springfield's Focus Deterrence, CU Fresh Start, and Peoria's Don't Shoot are based on a model that's been tried and tested across America since the mid-1990s. Peoria has had the program the longest and saw positive results early, though shootings have gone up and down. But some involved with the program, like Nathaniel Terry, say the numbers don't tell the whole story.
Sometimes you can reach people. A couple guys out of the program came to my church, got involved, and got jobs.
Terry lives in Peoria, good job, runs a prison ministry on the side, but in the past, he was in a gang where he did enough bad stuff to spend a decade in a state prison. Now, he tries to reach the young men at Peoria's call-ins.
You know, if it's like 1,000 men, sometimes you can reach one or two, and it's worth it even if you reach just that one or two.
Still, just about everyone involved with these programs say they're not enough. We need to get to those bigger issues of families and schools and distressed communities. But no one's holding their breath. And until it happens, the cities will keep trying to save their young men, one small group at a time. I'm Brian Mackey.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. This is Sound Ideas on GLT. Illinois is among the states looking to legalize betting after a Supreme Court decision overturned a federal ban. State Senator Napoleon Harris, a Democrat from Harvey and former NFL player, is sponsoring the proposal. IPR's Mary Hansen talked with Harris about the odds of getting a law passed to legalize sports betting.
In my mind, there's no question that Illinois is going to approve a sports law allowing gambling on sporting events. It's just a matter of when.
At a hearing on the subject, some worried that if the state didn't approve betting soon, it could lose a competitive advantage to other states who moved faster. Is there a rush to get this legislation passed?
Well, I think there's always somewhat of a concern when you look at neighboring states having the ability to do it as well. I definitely would like to be out in front of it before Wisconsin, Indiana, and Iowa, and Missouri, because they're so close bordering us, and where we have casinos aligned, they have casinos there as well. Like when you look at just my district in particular, Indiana is only maybe 3 miles, 4 miles, and they have casinos already there. If they allow gambling for sports in Indiana before they do Illinois, I could see a lot of Illinoisans just jumping aboard and placing bets.
Any gambling measure in Illinois often gets weighed down by all the vested interests, such as casinos, as you mentioned, video gaming parlors, horse race tracks. What's being done to make sure this bill doesn't stall like many other gaming bills have in the past?
Hopefully we don't run into that problem. I mean, I like to see this bill as a standalone bill and something that's just really focuses and driven on getting the sports betting portion handled and ironed out. I think that's a great start to generate revenue for the state. I think when you look at gaming overall, there's been estimates to say this is a $150 billion industry. I think that's real revenues that can really help a lot of people with all the things that we need to take care of in Illinois. When you talk about backlog of bills and pension costs, this money can go a long way with helping a lot of people.
Based on an estimate from a market research firm, that state revenue could be in the tens of millions of dollars. Is that enough to justify the cost of regulations plus the potential downsides to more gambling in the state?
Some people say, well, it's a, what they call the sin tax, like in Vegas. I look at it different. I look at it, it's something that people are doing anyway. So why not capitalize on the monetarily? Secondly, no one's forcing anyone to gamble. So if people don't gamble, or they don't see it being a need for them, or they feel that it's going to cause to other issues or problems, then don't do it.
Some of the pushback from professional sports leagues has been concerns about the integrity of the game, that legal betting will affect how games are played. You were in the NFL for a few years. How do you respond to that?
I realized a long time ago that regardless of what I thought or what I anticipated, that people were going to bet on sports. that didn't change my mantra of what I decided to do on Sundays when I played football. I wanted to give my best 100% of the time. I wanted to win the game, and I wanted to play extremely well. And I think most athletes, if not all athletes, believe that. There's prohibitions in that too. Athletes, of course, you're an athlete, you can't go and bet on a game. Or there's some thing there where, like, your spouse couldn't go bet on a game, or your next of kin. There's some parameters involved in there to clean it up.
What's the timeline for getting a vote on a sports betting bill?
Well, timeline is basically depending on how many people you can get to vote for it. So I'm really unclear on the timeline. You know, I really didn't anticipate the Supreme Court making a ruling as quickly as they did. The anticipation was to be somewhere around the summertime. We thought we had a little time doing veto session to maybe iron it out. But now that's definitely sped up the process. So now we're in, you know, speed mode.
State Senator Napoleon Harris talking with IPR's Mary Hansen about legalizing sports betting in Illinois. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT. Sound Ideas, I'm Mike McCurdy. As medical marijuana becomes more accepted and legal, some are finding the substance can help not only humans, but companion animals. Laura Kennedy has more in this edition of GLT's Animal House.
Many owners of pets suffering with arthritis or cancer are turning to medical marijuana to give their pets relief. While it's not currently legal for veterinarians to prescribe cannabis for pets, there's encouraging research showing that the drug can help pets. Despite promising signs, it's a tricky subject because in most states, it's illegal for veterinarians to even give advice regarding medical cannabis. Dr. Matt Fraker from the Prairie Oak Veterinary Center in Normal says there's classical medical uses for this particular product.
Pain. Pain in all forms and fashions. There's no question that we're seeing. They've finally been able to do some research. It would be fantastic if this country would just let us decide things on good science and research. We've gone in such a toxic direction from solid science and research, and I know that's a soapbox, and we'll probably get hate mail for that, but it's a darn truth of what's going on right now. So the medical benefits we're seeing specifically are very heavily weighed in pain, bone pain, arthritic pain, arthritis that's classic, metastatic bone disease, nausea, being an anti-emetic for nausea. It seems to have a very powerful anti-nausea properties. And then you start seeing sort of these nooks and cranny stuff, people with Parkinson's disease who completely settle down after they've been exposed to cannabis, or spasticity with multiple sclerosis. With our pets, we're really focusing on those same sort of key areas. Dogs with chronic arthritic pain who are almost immobile, primarily non-spinal arthritis, dogs who have seizure issues, and dogs who are facing nausea issues. Chemotherapy nausea is a great example. Some of our most powerful antiemetics, like ondansetron, Serenia, which is a wonder drug in pets, a wonder drug. Every sick dog should get a Serenia shot.
Can cats use it too?
Most of this research has been in dogs, to my knowledge.
So this is really early stage with trying to understand medical marijuana.
It's early stage
animals.
Because of the it's early stage because of the man. It's early stage because institutional resistance lingers. That's the great quote that you see. You Google that and you'll get about 800,000 research articles on marijuana. So Colorado is putting together a huge study right now. Cornell was doing a study. It sort of forced to shut down by the AVMA. They had sort of strict interpretation. There's a lot of worry about what's the federal government now going to do, since they're at odds with the state government. And what research was actually done, because it does help to actually have some research out there, have some dogs on placebos and dogs on a THC-based product, the research has been extremely promising. And remember, the placebo effect is also with the owner. So the owner doesn't know if the dog is getting olive oil or THC oil. Of course, the pet doesn't know. So humans can vary their response immensely in the face of the placebo effect. You tell them something good's happening and it kind of kicks in all of their internal healing options and they get a lot done just with their own body. Mm-hmm. You can't tell a pet that. You can't say, hey, this is really good stuff and it's a placebo and that you fake the dog out. The dog doesn't know what that is. So when we have a dog that is close to euthanasia because of mobility, for instance, there is a German Shepherd in one of these studies where the olive oil, the owner said it's not working and came in to put the dog to sleep. And the doctor said, well, let's try one more time. Let's try one more oil. And it was the THC oil. And the response was amazing. So there's really this tremendous potential for medical benefits. And yes, they do seem to work in dogs. And I'll be honest, it's funny because veterinarians are sort of scared to talk about it. And you have to keep in mind, we've always been in this funny position with marijuana to begin with because pets love to eat the stuff.
And if they get into their owner's stash.
Exactly. And these are not necessarily animals who need pain relief. They just, somebody, ooh. Yeah.
It's eat first,
it
ask
must
questions
taste
later.
Good. I haven't eaten a whole lot of marijuana, but apparently it tastes really good. And when these animals come in, marijuana toxic, and once you've seen a couple of them, you recognize them pretty quickly. And we're faced with, and it has become so much easier now, but in 10, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, did your dog get in any marijuana? No, of course not. And then you're like, you whisper, blah, 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 this dog definitely got into marijuana. So then you go to the owners and you say, well, we're going to do blood work, x-rays, put them on IV fluids. You know, we don't know what's going on, so we have to spend about $600 to $1,000. If there's any possibility this dog might have gotten into marijuana, we know the vast majority of these animals do fine. We just have to watch it and wait it out. Everything's going to be fine. Oh, you know what? My friend came over the other day, and I think they might have, it's always. But nowadays, we can have that conversation, but there's still a lot of veterinarians who are uncomfortable discussing the option of marijuana or THC or cannabis in pets with chronic pain. And I know I've been asked by several clients, and I'm very comfortable saying, hey, I absolutely, if you want to try it out, feel free. Because we should be reaching out to something that has this kind of promise with the kind of things that are really some of the worst things we see in medicine. Chronic pain is one of the worst things we deal with in medicine. Chemotherapy-induced nausea is one of the, talk about a downer. If you're getting chemotherapy, you're already not in a happy place, and then have to deal with the nausea and everything. And our patients get some of that nausea too. They actually do a lot better with chemo than humans do, but they still can run into the nausea issue or have issues that are chronic vomiting issues that aren't chemotherapy related. And certainly, if we have something to add to our arsenal of anti-seizure medicines, because our arsenal right now is a lot of drugs that come with baggage. Phenobarbital is a great anti-seizure medicine, but you're going to have to track that dog's liver for the rest of its life. Potassium bromide, great anti-seizure medicine, but difficult to get dogs on initially. It's salty. It's like drinking concentrated salt water. That's not good. The animal doesn't enjoy that. And there's some newer medicines that are out there. But here's a medicine where when you also look at the negative effects of using this substance, I shouldn't call it a medicine. You'll be my first phone call when I go to jail after this interview. My name's not Dr. Matt Frager. But certainly if we have a chemical, a substance that has such a, what seems to be a fairly large safety margin on top of everything else, this thing has what research is showing a fairly large safety margin both in humans and in pets, what research has been done. It just seems silly that we aren't relaxing, taking a big deep breath and letting us kind of explore what other options we have for the substance.
Matt, when we're giving our pet marijuana, does the pet get stoned?
My minimal experience and what I've read is these are small amounts. I have not done any research into the drug dosages. I have had firsthand reports from certain owners who asked me, who said, hey, I'm going to try this. And these are quality of life, preparing for euthanasia discussions. We haven't seen that. Now, there's a huge difference between leaving that bag out and the dog eats the entire thing, versus a controlled amount of the THC oil. And I think right now, a lot of this research is looking at the oil because you have such control over the dosage that way. And it isn't getting your dog high to keep them comfortable. These animals that are on the oil in these research studies are trotting and they're upbeat and they're happy to see their owners and they're eating well. and some of these animals were very close to euthanasia before their quality of life was turned around by employing THC in their medical management.
Well, what's the future of this? Do you see it getting approved? Do you see this taking
I can't
hold?
Believe with what we're learning about both the recreational use of this drug and the medical use of this drug. And I don't care. I don't have any skin in the game on the recreational usage, except for the fact that I think, in my personal opinion, a very strong overreaction to recreational usage is really hindering our access to medical usage. And of course, that there's abuse out there. The medical access to marijuana, I know that's all happening. But if we can get through, this is forest and trees all the way. Like, however we want to figure out this battle on the ground, the researchers aren't going to do any of the above. They're not going to abuse this drug. They're not going to black market this drug. They're really going to try to give us the kind of information we really need. So if we do someday have a more free access to this product as something we can use, then we'll know how to use it. And we'll be able to make owners who freak out at the thought of acquiring THC, but their animals are in a lot of pain. It would just be nice if everyone could leave the research alone. You know, if they want to mess with all that other stuff, that's fine, but leave the researchers alone. Let them figure this stuff out.
That's Dr. Matt Fraker from the Prairie Oak Veterinary Center in Normal. I'm Laura Kennedy.
In addition to arthritis, medical cannabis has been used to treat dermatitis, inflammation, and anxiety in pets. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas. This is WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find the Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Ryan Denham, Laura Kennedy, and Charlie Schlenker. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast, or you can try Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post your comments at Facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet your comments. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm at Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.